seated. Our first case this morning is case number 69166. Help me with the name, Mr. Farland.
Ken Nguyen or Nugent.
Thank you. And versus Boynes. Mrs. McFarland for the appellate, Mr. Quinman for the respondent. Mr. McFarland, you ready to go? And did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay.
There have been situations where we have needed our laws to recognize the relationship between a parent and a child that's not the biological child of that person, and to recognize it as a parent-child relationship. Because in the past, there's been difficulty under the law for that type of relationship to be established, especially in situations where there are same-sex couples. And that's a reality of our history. But fortunately, our laws have changed, and we now have the situation where two men can be married, where two men can be domestic partners, where two men can have a child that is the child of both of theirs. And that is legal under our laws at this moment, and the domestic partnership and the two fathers was legal at all times relevant in this case as well. We also now have laws that allow for determinations of parentage in assisted reproduction situations where you have an egg donor or a sperm donor. Our law has come around to a point where we have mechanisms to establish and make sure that the rights of all parents that are intended to be parents are legally recognized. And so situations such as the SY case that out of California that was a large basis of the judge's decision in this, those kinds of carve-outs aren't necessary anymore. Now, there might be situations, holdover situations, such as that one, the main element of that case being that these people, there was a military person during the don't ask, don't tell era in the military. And, you know, that was a bit of a holdover. But even that's now gone. So we have a situation where the two men in this case had the ability at all times for both of them to be legally recognized as fathers of this child, and they didn't. And if we allow our paternity statute, and you know, we have this paternity statute that allows for a presumption that a man is the natural father when the child has been received into his home and openly holds the child out as his natural child. We have that in our statutes. And certainly there are situations and situations where you have a man and a woman who has a child, where that comes into play often. But we have to be very, very careful when we take that statute and we expand it to situations where it shouldn't be, where we expand it to situations where it tramples on someone's parental rights, and we expand it to situations where there are legal mechanisms to have established that parent-child relationship that the parties knew about and didn't take. And that is the situation here. There's this case involves two gay men, and because of that fact, and I think that the how far the district court judge went in trying to give rights, any type of rights, to Mr. Boynes in this case, maybe a symptom of him saying, you know, because of that situation, we have to be overly careful, we have to be overly protective, we have to make sure that we expand these laws. But in this case, that fact isn't a relevant fact, because these two men were legally able to be domestic partners. They were legally able to both adopt this child. And so we have that we look at this case thinking of the ramifications if we expand this concept to male-female relationships, which is going to be the most common scenario that these facts could apply to. It is a very, very common thing for a woman to have a child, there's not a father around, there's a man who's involved in that child's life, and the facts of this case would allow for expansion into situations that people don't intend or don't expect. So if you allow a man who has had an involvement in a child's life, which is common, to go in and assert paternity rights against the lawful, legal, only parent of a child, you are then opening the door to boyfriends, girlfriends, guardians, step-parents, to make claims that they have other, more appropriate legal matters.
Aren't those all considerations, though, that are going to be made by a judge on a case-by-case basis, based upon the fact and the nature of the relationship between the child and the parents seeking relief?
Absolutely. And there are situations where we need to utilize this statute, where there is a person who is not the biological child. But this case is not that case. And this court, hopefully, will make very clear that there are very specific situations where this statute should not apply. The situations, specifically, when both people know that a man is not the biological father, they should be held to a higher standard in using this statute. Most of the cases that have come down where this statute is used by the man seeking paternity rights, it's a situation where he didn't know that he wasn't the dad for some period of time, and there's an establishment of a relationship based upon fraud or a misrepresentation or even a lack of awareness by the mother. That's a situation that would warrant this statute being applied when the father didn't know for some period of time that he was in a relationship.
Haven't we opened the door in Love to a broader interpretation of this statute? I mean, looking at natural father, if one applies the Black's Law Dictionary, we're talking about a biological father, and the statute seemingly, under that definition, only applied to that father. In Love, we seem to have opened the door to a non-biological father and considering other factors. Since that decision, how does one approach this statute any other way than what the district court did? It seems to permit an evaluation of factors other than the biological relationship between the father and the child.
And I think there are situations, and like I said, if the father knew he wasn't the father, there should be a higher standard than if he didn't know.
So what
and
that's one standard, part out,
but in another,
what would that standard consist of? Now, we've opened the door in Love for this alternative consideration, a non-biological consideration. What should the factors be that you're advocating? What guidance can we provide to the district courts when faced with these fact patterns?
Some very specific recommendations on that. One is that, and Love notes this line, a child under the age of 3. And there's a significance to that line, under age of 3, because children don't remember things that happened before a certain age. And so a relationship that has developed over even a period of an entire 3-year period under age 3 isn't going to be the same as a relationship that develops between, say, a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old, especially over time. So
we're getting over our skis here. Isn't this the province of the legislature to, if we're going to go down the non-biological father path, maybe the legislature should be debating what these factors are, not this court?
It's certainly a situation where they could put elements in, but this court also has the ability to go in and make sure that the interpretation of this provision of our statutes has has elements to it. Another suggestion that I have is how long the period of holding out is. In this SY case out of California, it was many, many years, and then the parties were separated for 2.5 years after being together with the children in their homes, that this child was held out, or children were held out. That's a long period of time, regardless of the age of the children. And so we have this three-year-old line of children under three should be treated a certain way, and also the length of time of holding out. If someone holds a child out as their own for 10 years, that's way more significant than someone who holds a child out as their own for 6 months or even a year, especially during the time period of under 3 years. That amount of time may be looked at differently. So the amount of time in this case was a year at most, and 11 months, I guess. I mean, 13 months.
Now, why then is quantity of time more significant to you than quality of time?
Well, the three-year-old, I guess, gets to quality of time, because that's going to be what the child remembers or doesn't. And so that's what that line would be under 3 years old, is quality of time or quality of memory. But quantity...
Why can't that be a factor in the judge's determination?
It should be. Absolutely. Quality of time and quantity of time should be considered. If you have a child that's in someone's care the type of relationship that they have and the age of the child, certainly it should be considered. In this case, we have a child. The year was from that child's birth until that child was, I think, 13 months old. That the quality of time of a relationship that establishes during the first 13 months of a child's life is of a different quality as, say, a 13-month period from when the child is 8 to 9. There's just a different quality, and there's a different attachment, and there's a different impact on a child.
Where do you find a basis for that exactly? Have you cited that in your briefs, and what authority do you have to support that?
The age 3 comes from the Love case, and you know, obviously it's just one sentence. It doesn't go into a lot of the details as to why, but quality of time I think is the most obvious reason for it. But certainly in any situation, any time that we have a your proof is based upon having done something for a period of time, the amount of time that you do that for, it, the longer it is, the stronger that claim is going to be.
Ms. McFarling, why is it relevant then that the district court found that the child was with Mr. Boynes for the first 15 months? Like, what, you know, the time factor here, certainly at the time that this incident happened, the baby went straight to Mr. Boynes' home.
Right.
He was held out as a child. He was held out as a child prior to the birth of the child. So why don't we apply St. Mary's? Why don't we give deference to the court's factual findings here based upon the evidence and the credibility determinations, frankly, that were made?
The difference between St. Mary, biggest difference in this case, they had a custody agreement in St. Mary. In this case, they did not. And the credibility and the factual findings are of biggest concern in this case, because there's so much dispute as to the intentions. And there is a ton of evidence of my client having clearly told or had other people tell Mr. Boynes, "You're not adopting. We're not doing a second adoption. I'm not adding."
Wasn't there also a great deal of evidence the other direction? There were text messages that were uncovered. There was all kinds of other factors that the judge very specifically and methodically set out in his decision.
And
why wouldn't that be substantial evidence to support that decision?
The communications of a legal relationship, "I'm not going to have you adopt, I'm not going to add you to the birth certificate, and you're a good dad." I tell my children, "Stepfather, you're a good dad to my children," all the time. It doesn't mean I am suggesting that he can file for paternity over my children by doing that. There's a huge difference between familial relation titles, especially given the evidence of how loosely familial titles are used in my client's heritage and culture. But there's a big difference when you're making informal communications.
What about all the actions and activities leading up to the adoption and Mr. Boynes primarily taking on this responsibility to make sure all the paperwork was filled out, making trips down to California, making the primary contacts with Catholic charities, and just the involvement he had from the very beginning, and the apparent agreement, I can't say, but the apparent understanding that they were both going to be the parents. Why isn't that supported by the record?
And I think this gets to what the judge focused on. We have my client having hired Jewish Family Services and the person, Ann Coleman, testifying that Rob told her he was not going to be adopting this child at all. We have a child that is a potential placement that they go to, and that mother only relinquishes to my client. This is through an adoption.
Charities?
Huh?
This is through Catholic Charities.
This was through Jewish Family Services, who allowed a dual adoption as well.
That was in the first instance.
The first instance. So,
and the second instance where he said he wasn't adopting was because of their particular policies.
Correct. But the fact that he wasn't adopting in the second one is diluted by the fact that when he could, he didn't.
But Ms. McFarland, I'm sorry, is there evidence in the record, though, that was considered, and there was issue about Mr. Boynes perhaps not having a good financial picture, there was a bankruptcy involved. There were issues why the district court could conclude that the parties intended to parent together but didn't intend to at least put themselves out to the Jewish charities, or, and I'm sorry if I'm misstating the name of the agency, but why they may not want to do that to make the adoption have the best chance of success.
While that was Rob's testimony, that he had a bankruptcy and there was a financial impact, there was zero other evidence, and certainly conflicting evidence from Ann Coleman and my client, that his bankruptcy or his financial situation had any impact on his ability or his decision to tell Ann Coleman, I will not be adopting. There wasn't even a discussion with her from her testimony, Ann Coleman's testimony, that this that maybe he could, but there's a financial problem. It was a clear, I am not going to. We also look at the history of these parties' relationship. My client's not a native English speaker. He had Rob assist him with paperwork in a lot of other situations. So the fact that he was involved in this situation is more representative of their relationship in that regard, in him assisting him in those types of matters.
Your time's up, but I'm going to give you 2 minutes of a rebuttal. And Mr. Thank Freeman, you. I'm going to give you 17 minutes. I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes because I'm going to give Ms. McFarland the extra two. So you have a full 17 minutes.
Good afternoon, Justices. Jack Freeman of Staples Law Group, representing the respondent, Robert Boynes, who is present in the courtroom today. At its heart, this case is about the love of a parent for a child. It is about the love of a father, regardless of his sexual orientation and regardless of his biological connection for his son. And it's about that son's best interests, which can only be served by an affirmance of the lower court's finding of paternity and custody in this case. The district court, as this court noted, issued a very lengthy decision with many findings. Among those findings, that the paternity presumption statute applied, that the paternity presumption was not rebutted, that it was the intent of these parties to co-parent this child, and that it was in the child's best interest to award joint legal and joint physical custody. Whether the presumption applies is a question of law for this court, and petitioners argued that it shouldn't apply. The other findings of fact are findings that should be affected with deference by this court, because the judge, as a prior fact, was in the position after 13 days of trial in this case to make those determinations. In reviewing the district court's decision, we must first look at the statute. The statute provides that there's a paternity presumption where, during a child's minority, a man receives a child into his home and openly holds out the child as his natural child. Petitioner's filings in this case have made mention that the child, there was no familial home, there was not one family home. I would note that the statute says in his home. And the fact is that from day one, from the day the child was placed, after the child was a few days old, the child was held out in his home. These parties, although they were in a relationship, never had one familial home. This is somewhat similar to the SY case out of California, where in that case, the parties kind of stayed in one home with the children, but they maintained two separate residences. The district court found that the statute does apply to Mr. Boynes in this case. At that point, the burden shifted to the petitioner to rebut the presumption by clear and convincing evidence. Now,
what about the natural child piece of this? Sure. Knowing the definition of natural child, mm-hmm. and knowing that this child was, by everybody's account, adopted, how could you legitimately say that the child was held out as his natural child?
Sure. Well, one, I think that the jurisprudence has changed over time, and that the Love case did open that door, as well as St. Mary and other cases out of state, such as S.Y. I think, indeed, he did, in fact, hold himself out as if he were the natural father of the child. Now, not explicitly that he could be, but there's jurisprudence across this country, and petitioner...
I think it wasn't in Love, didn't... I think it was confused until some point in the proceeding when there was a DNA test. I haven't reread Love recently, but I'm not sure that it opens the door as far as you're opening it.
I don't think Love opened it all the way. I think that the other cases that have followed with St. Mary and
well, St. Mary's had a specific contract.
Sure, and the trend among the states as well, In re Phillips from Kansas, other cases in California, in those cases, it's detailed that fathers from very early age knew that the children weren't their children, specifically In re Phillips in Kansas, which petitioner cites in the reply brief. It states that that father, by age one and two of the children, knew he wasn't the biological father, and yet held himself out after that. And what the court said is, look, we don't find that biology is determinative. There's so many other factors.
I'm not saying it is, but you're talking about a legal presumption that's stated in the statute, and I'm trying to work it into the language of the statute. I don't know how you can, in good faith, hold out that you're the natural father when you know for a fact you're not.
I think that the statute could probably be interpreted a number of ways. If a person holds a child out as if it is their natural child, I think it would be a bit weird if the statute included...
And if that's enough, then you have a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, or as your opposing colleague describes the stepfather of her children, she says you're a great dad. I assume when he picks him up at a baseball game, he doesn't necessarily say, these are not my biological children, but they're my kids. I mean, people don't hasten to add all that.
Right, and I think this case in particular is so fact-dependent because there's so many other things with all the facts of them agreeing that they were going to, you know, as some of the evidence suggests and as the court found, they agreed they were going to have a second adoption, they agreed that they were going to co-parent, all of those things. I mean, in the St. Mary case, there was a written agreement. In this case, I would say there were a number of writings that formulated that one agreement that they were going to co-parent. And so under the plain language of the statute, I acknowledge that it is difficult, but I think that it would be odd for the statute to have these other presumptive factors and when in so many cases you may know. I mean, you may have met a woman while she was pregnant very early on and known that she's pregnant and then held that child out as if it was your own natural child. I don't think that the statute...
This has implications for inheritance rights. It has all kinds of implications.
Sure, it does, as well as you know, adoption cases and termination of paternal cases, all those types
And how many parents is a child going to have? And
I think the district court is in the best position to look at the facts of each individual case and be able to apply the presumption. And while there is a supposed danger if some grifter comes along or even a step-parent who's a loving step-parent of filing something, I think the facts of those cases are going to be where the district court can say, look, this raises a presumption, but it's a rebuttable presumption, and I can look at it and see what the facts are. And in this case in particular, I think the facts really lend themselves to what the trend has been in saying that, look, these biological factors are not determinative. There are other factors that we should look at.
Wouldn't a better approach be to, rather than invoking the presumption under the statute, to look instead at just the factors of the particular case? Did the parties enter into an agreement, oral or written, to co-parent? Rather than providing one party a presumption over another party in those circumstances, why not place the parties who are claiming a parental relationship on an equal footing and let the district court sort it out without the insertion of a presumption statute that is awkwardly drafted and awkwardly applicable to this situation?
Well, I don't know that the statutory scheme would allow such a thing for the court to determine legal parentage without really looking at whether there are presumptions, or conclusive or otherwise, under the facts of this case, I don't think...
Well, in light of what this court did in St. Mary, that was a fundamental underpinning of that.
Sure, but I don't think that the court is placing the parties on an unequal footing. They're not taking the parental rights away from the adoptive parent in this situation. Or in St. Mary, you know, you're not taking away the fundamental rights of a parent. You were trying to establish a second parent, which, under the policy of the state, it's beneficial for a child to have two actively involved parents. And I think under the statute, I think it fits the scheme nicely that there is a presumption that can be rebutted where the court can consider, because paternity cases are necessarily child custody cases, because if you're establishing parenting rights, you're establishing fundamental rights of the parent, you're establishing legal custody rights, best interest is always needs to be looked at in those cases. So I don't think that it would be unfair to put the statute in and interpret it this way, because I think that it doesn't put the parents on unequal footing. I think it just tells one parent, okay, it's presumed that the other person is a parent as well, which may indeed be best for this child to have these two actively involved parents, and then the district court can look at it and review all the evidence and make a determination as to whether or not this person indeed, as it was in this case, held out to be a parent by both parents, encouraged to be a second parent by the adoptive parent. And it's so similar to the SY case, which petitioner mentioned, and I think this court should look towards the SY case, even though it's just persuasive authority, because in the SY case, it wasn't about the don't ask, don't tell policy, although that was mentioned, and petitioner brings it up. That was not the basis for the court's ruling. In that case, it said, look, where a person who's a non-adoptive parent holds a child out from birth, which is what it was in this case, and that adoptive parent then encourages that second person to act as a second parent, and there's a presumption that applies to them, and that person accepts that responsibility, they should be deemed a parent. And that's almost exactly what happened here. Now, there is some quantitative difference in the time. It was 15 months here rather than many, many years, but I don't think there is a bright line, three-year-old division. I think the court needs to look at each case individually and determine qualitatively what the relationship is with the potential parent. In love, the three-year-old threshold that was mentioned is actually a reference to a California case and an old California statute, and that statute was really about child support and essentially said, look, once a child turns the age of three, if you've been holding them out as your own child, you can't later say, hey, I want a DNA test because I don't want to pay child support. Once they're 3 years old, that time is gone, and that was up to the California legislature to put that into place, but it really didn't, if you look at the history of that, have anything to do with, hey, once a child is 3 years old, their bonds have formed in such a way that, you know, you can't, biology isn't such a factor. It's also kind of a reverse logic in that what the petitioner argues is because beyond the age of three, biology is not the determinative factor, then below the age of three, it must be. But I think we still need to look at the individual facts of the case. petitioners also argued that there was no marriage or domestic partnership in this case, and that there could have been. In the St. Mary case, again, the policy was stated that the best interest is served by two involved parents, that a child of same-sex domestic partners has no less rights than to two parents.
Yeah. Wasn't the couple in St. Mary's in a formal domestic partnership?
Yes.
Legal union that had been achieved?
Right, I believe so. But in the dicta of St. Mary,
right. I'm not disputing the language. I was just trying to establish.
Sure, and it says the intent of the legislature is to allow non-biological factors to be critical in the paternity determination. They even talked about paternity in addition to maternity, and that ultimately preservation is strengthening the family in this state. If this court deems that the presumption is not applicable, the court could also decide to expand the equitable adoption doctrine in the state.
Haven't we always been hesitant to do that?
Yes, the court has always been hesitant in Russo and Fry.
Fairly explicit.
Sure. But I do think that an equitable remedy could be fashioned if the statute didn't apply. Family courts, by their nature, are very equitable and really look out best interests and what's fair to the child, what's fair to the parties.
The child's not represented here.
Pardon?
The child's not represented in this lawsuit.
No, the child is not represented. In Hermanson, the court reversed because the court didn't analyze the presumptions under the statute. But here, the court went in depth and did analyze the statute, went bit by bit through best interests, and issued a very lengthy opinion. Petitioner in the paperwork argues that there are errors in some of the factual findings, and I would agree there are some errors, but after a 13-day trial, it's understandable that there are some mistakes. There was substantial evidence elsewhere to support.
Could this have been structured as St. Mary's was, premised on an agreement without the presumption? Or is there some omission in the proof or contest here that made St. Mary's inapplicable? Do you follow the question?
I think I do. In terms of St. Mary, I do think it probably could have been structured through an agreement. And I think the court could have made a finding. And potentially, it can be pieced together from the court's findings that it did. But there was an explicit agreement between these parties to co-parent. And perhaps even on the issue of whether there should or shouldn't have been a second adoption. But the court chose to go with the presumption and apply it in this case.
Isn't some glaring, this is different from St. Mary's because, at least that you're willing to share.
I mean, there are many things that are different about it than St. Mary's, it's paternity rather than maternity. In that case, there were domestic partners. There are quite a few differences, but I think the underlying policy rationale and that you can have two mothers, that you can have two fathers, that it's in the best, interest, for lack of a better word, of a child to have that. I think it's more akin to St. Mary's in the rationale in St. Mary's than it isn't.
But they didn't rely on a presumption. It was a contractual.
Correct. Paternity statute's a little different than the maternity statute. Yeah. With respect to some of the petitioner's specific arguments, they argue that it is a carve-out. I don't believe that it is a carve-out. I do think the statute could apply, and I do think it could be applied in such a way that holding yourself out as the natural parent can easily be interpreted. And honestly, when I first read the statute, I kind of thought it was, which doesn't carry any weight with the court, but I honestly thought that it meant if you hold the person out as if it was your own child, and that, in the facts of this case where everyone kind of holds it out that way, and you have a joint baby shower, and you have joint cards, and you have a joint baptism, and you give the child the other person's middle name, and that person has a room and a nursery that you helped build, and you let the child, after you break up, go to North Carolina to visit family for Thanksgiving, and all these things happen where you refer to the other person as dad and daddy and our son, and these things happen for a long period of time, a year, May to May, I believe it was 2015 when it ended. But those things happened where both sides were holding him out as dad. And I think that's important in this case. And I disagree with the petitioner's argument that the judge was being overly protective and just saying, look, I need to find rights here for this dad. I think that the judge was clearly recognizing that there was probably going to be some harm to this child based on the facts that he had seen. And may have, for that reason, issued alternative rulings of, well, if there's not this, then you can have equitable adoption. If there's not this, then I think third-party visitation. But I really think this court is probably focused on whether the presumption applies, and I think that it does, or whether there was, in fact, an explicit agreement between these parties that they would be joint parents in this case. So often in these cases involving young children, there's a difficult decision to make, and biology is up against nurture. And the court is required to make a decision to either separate a child from a loving home or to sever the biological parent's rights. These types of cases are where the heart and mind and the law and the facts are in opposition. Thankfully, I don't believe that's this type of case. That is this type of case. The facts and the law, I believe, are on the same side in this case, and I think so too should the heart and the mind be. This child can keep two parents, and there's no biology in this case that's battling nurture. And I believe there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that supported the district court's findings in this case. So respectfully, on behalf of Mr. Boynes, I request the court affirm the lower court's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you have about 2 minutes.
We have adoption laws that spell out the process for how two people can become parents to a child that isn't the biological child of either one of them. And in a situation such as this, you become domestic partners, you live together and you do a joint adoption. You become domestic partners and you live together and you do two adoptions in a row. Or you don't become domestic partners, you do two adoptions in a row and it requires a home study. Those are the rules. Those are the requirements for an adoption. Both of these people fully knew that and went through a lot of information about how that works, and they didn't do it. It was just said that there was an intention of a second adoption. There was an attorney who represented my client in the adoption, and that attorney did not testify. And in fact, Rob testified that he had a conversation with that attorney at the adoption hearing where Ken adopted. Ken was not going to have a second adoption. There was not a single piece of documentary or third-party evidence that there was any action taken towards a second adoption or towards any of these.
Wasn't that also part of the Catholic Charities requirements is going through the adoption process?
Was, I'm sorry, I missed your question?
They would not be co-adopted parents.
And,
why wouldn't
that
he say
that? That was one of those three options that I gave in the beginning. You could do consecutive adoptions through Catholic Charities, and that happened all the time. And one reason why Catholic Charities did not...
You just made a statement to the attorney during the hearing, and that's consistent with Catholic Charities and their policies.
Correct, but a second adoption could have been timed to occur the next day. It could have been set up. There could have been an attorney hired. The only communications in writing about any kind of legal relationship was about guardianship, and that's undisputed, that there were communications about guardianship. If you allow these people to be confirmed as paternity, you are giving an end around to our adoption laws that are in place for a reason. You should only allow a situation such as this if there isn't another legal remedy.
Thank you. Thanks you, Ms. McFarland, and you, Mr. Fleeman, for the spirited debate and argument and your briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.